Have you ever like wondered, I mean, really thought about how the way an appeals court like looks at a case, you know, the standard they use can totally change whether someone goes free or stays behind bars.
Or maybe you've thought about like what happens when, a defense attorney just doesn't do their homework, not really prepared for trial.
Yeah, like what are the consequences of that for their client, right?
Absolutely. And that's actually what we're going to be diving deep into today. We're going to be looking at two cases, both from Texas, both criminal appeals, and would you believe it, they both have the exact same name.
It's kind of crazy, right? Both cases are called Brooks v. State of Texas. One's from 1964, and the other, get this, from 2010.
Yeah. So you might think, oh, a legal sequel? But, trust me, these cases are like totally different beasts. They shine a light on really important but distinct aspects of the Texas justice system.
Totally. Okay, so the 1964 Brooks case, that one goes deep into the idea of what makes for ineffective assistance of counsel, which is huge, obviously.
Right, like did the lawyer do their job well enough? And then it also delves into the question of whether an insanity defense should have been considered.
And then fast forward to the 2010 Brooks case. That one's all about like how should appeals courts be reviewing evidence? You know, how much scrutiny should they apply? It's a really fundamental question.
Exactly. So today, by the time we're done, you'll have a much better grasp of some pretty major changes in Texas criminal procedure and appeals, and we'll see it all through these two cases.
I love it. Shared name, totally different stories, totally different impact on the law in Texas.
Right.
Okay, so let's start with the 1964 case, kind of the granddaddy of the two.
Right. So this one was about a guy, Brooks, who was convicted in Dallas County for assault with intent to rape back in 64.
Right.
The prosecution presented all these facts. Brooks entered the victim's bedroom at night. He was caught a few days later. And the prosecution had a bunch of evidence, the victim's ID, another witness who saw him leaving the victim's room, evidence that he ran away after the alleged assault.
Sounds like a strong case for the prosecution so far.
Oh, yeah. And they even had a written confession from Brooks himself.
Wow. Okay. So where does the appeal come in then?
Well, this is where things get interesting. So Brooks had a court-appointed attorney, public defender, and this attorney, he only met with Brooks for the first time 3 days before the trial started.
3 days. Oh my gosh. That doesn't seem like a lot of time to get ready for a trial.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And that lack of prep time, that becomes a major, major issue in the appeal.
Okay, so the short prep time, that's a big deal. What exactly was the argument on appeal? What were they claiming went wrong?
So there were two big legal questions at the heart of the appeal. First, because of the limited time the lawyer had, did Brooks actually get what the law calls effective assistance of counsel? Like, was his lawyer good enough?
That makes sense, yeah. And what was the second question?
The second question was whether Brooks's potential insanity at the time of the offense was even looked into.
Ah, okay. So let's dive deeper into this ineffective assistance of counsel claim. What were they specifically saying the lawyer messed up on?
Well, the main argument was that Brooks' lawyer didn't do enough to investigate his mental state, which is kind of shocking because there were signs, right? Like a psychiatrist actually examined Brooks before the trial.
There was a psych eval.
Yeah, and it wasn't just a quick check-in. The psychiatrist actually found that while Brooks may have understood the difference between right and wrong on a basic level, his ability to actually make judgments about those things was, and I quote, "a good deal impaired."
Wow. Okay, so that sounds potentially significant.
It is. In fact, the psychiatrist went even further and said Brooks's understanding in this area and his ability to make judgments was not even as good as the average person or even the average felon.
Okay, so alarm bells should be going off at that point, right?
Exactly. And, all that was just totally ignored.
Wow. Okay, so back in 1964, what was the standard in Texas for figuring out whether someone got bad legal representation, ineffective assistance of counsel? It seems like those standards must change over time.
You're totally right, they do. Back then, in 64, Texas used something called the Mockery of Justice Test. It's different from the standard we use now, which is based on a U.S. Supreme Court case called Strickland v. Washington. But this Mockery of Justice Test, it was a lot harder to prove.
So how did it work? What did you have to show?
So it wasn't about pointing out specific errors the lawyer made. It was more about proving that because of what the lawyer did or didn't do, the whole trial was basically unfair, like so bad that it was a sham.
Oh, I see. So did Brooks's case, did it meet that mockery of justice standard?
They absolutely did. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, they were not messing around.
Yeah.
They overturned the whole conviction, they reversed it, saying straight up that Brooks' trial was no more than a mockery of justice. And They really hammered on the fact that his lawyer was so unprepared and that he totally failed to investigate this potential insanity defense, especially after what the psychiatrist said. It just wasn't right.
So even with this super high bar to prove ineffective assistance, the court decided the lawyer's performance was so bad it threw out the conviction.
Yep. They basically said that without a proper investigation into the mental health aspect, there was no real defense at all.
Okay, so this case happened more than 50 years ago. Why is it still important today? Why should law students care about this old mockery of justice standard?
Well, even though the mockery of justice test isn't really used anymore, the idea behind it, that's still relevant. The idea that every defendant deserves a competent lawyer who explores all possible defenses, that's a bedrock principle. And it's especially important when we're talking about mental health issues.
That makes a lot of sense. It shows how important it is to be thorough and to really fight for your clients.
Absolutely. The 1964 Brooks case is a powerful reminder that a lawyer's got to be ready to go deep, to really investigate, especially when mental capacity is at play. Otherwise, it's like there's no defense at all, no matter what legal test you're using.
So important. Okay, let's move on to the second Brooks v. Texas case, the one from 2010. This one's about something completely different, right?
Totally different. So this one involved Kelvin Brooks, a guy convicted for intent to deliver more than 4 grams, but less than 200 grams of crack cocaine.
Okay.
So the cops got a tip about a guy matching Kelvin's description who supposedly had a gun. They saw him outside a bar, asked him to step out, and guess what?
What happened?
He bolted, took off running, and while he was running, he tossed away 2 baggies. One had weed, the other had crack cocaine and some ecstasy tablets. They caught him, and he was later convicted.
So unlike the 1964 case, which focused on what Brooks's lawyer did, this one's about the evidence the prosecution used and how appeals courts in Texas review that kind of evidence, right?
Exactly. The big legal debate in the 2010 Brooks was all about the standards of review for evidence in appeals. So before this case, Texas actually had 2 different standards. It was kind of messy. One was called the Jackson v. Virginia standard, which was all about legal sufficiency. The other was the Cluis v. State standard, which looked at factual sufficiency.
Okay, so we have legal sufficiency and factual sufficiency. I gotta be honest, those terms can be a bit confusing. Can you break it down for us?
Sure, no problem. So the Jackson v. Virginia standard, that's about legal sufficiency, and it basically comes from federal law. It asks this question: looking at all the evidence in a way that helps the prosecution, could any rational jury have found the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt?
So it's about whether there was enough evidence legally to support the conviction.
Right. And it gives a lot of respect to what the jury decided. The appeals court's not reweighing all the evidence. They're just checking if there was any legal basis for the jury to say guilty.
Okay, I get it. So what about factual sufficiency under the Cluis standard? How is that different?
So Cluis gave the appeals courts more power. They could act like another juror, a 13th juror. Even if there was some evidence for a conviction under Jackson, under Cluis, the court could still overturn the verdict if they thought it went against the weight of the evidence, like if they thought it was just plain wrong or unfair.
How interesting. So Cluis gave them more leeway to disagree with the jury.
Yeah, it did. It was like, even if the prosecution side of the scale had some weight, the appeals court could look at everything and say, nah, the defense side is way heavier. This verdict doesn't make sense.
I see. So in the 2010 Brooks case, what happened with these 2 standards?
Well, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals made a huge decision. They decided to get rid of Cluis altogether. They threw out factual sufficiency review and said from now on, Texas appeals courts would only use the Jackson v. Virginia standard to review evidence.
Wow. So they just went with 1 standard?
Yeah, just Jackson. Big change.
So why did they do that? Why get rid of Cluis?
Justice Hervey wrote the majority opinion, and he explained it pretty clearly. One of the main problems was that Cluis was mixing ideas from civil and criminal law in a weird way. In civil cases, the burden of proof is lower. It's preponderance of the evidence, meaning more likely than not. But in criminal cases, it's beyond a reasonable doubt, which was way harder to prove. They thought using a civil idea in criminal cases was just wrong.
Okay, so mixing those standards, different burdens of proof, didn't make sense to them.
Exactly. The majority basically said that the Jackson standard, which just looks at whether any rational juror could convict, was enough to ensure a fair review. It also showed more respect for the jury's role in deciding the facts.
It seems like the court was really concerned about the jury's role and making sure the appeals court wasn't stepping on their toes too much. Were there any other opinions about this? Any disagreements?
You know what? Big decisions like this, there are always different views. Justice Cochran, he actually agreed with getting rid of Cluis. He thought it was a bad idea to use a civil standard in a criminal case. But Justice Price, he wrote a pretty strong dissent, meaning he disagreed with the majority.
Oh, interesting. What did he think?
He argued that under the Texas Constitution, appeals courts do have the power to review the facts. He was worried that without Cluis, there might be more wrongful convictions because there wouldn't be that extra check on whether the evidence really supported the verdict.
So he thought Cluis was an important safeguard, an extra layer of protection.
Exactly. He believed that Jackson was good for seeing if there was any evidence at all, but Cluis was about whether that evidence was actually strong and believable enough.
Makes sense. So the 2010 Brooks case definitely shook things up in Texas. It made things simpler in a way, but it also caused a lot of debate about how appeals should work. What's the bottom line for lawyers in Texas now after this decision?
Well, the biggest change is that when lawyers are appealing a case in Texas and arguing about the evidence, they can only use the Jackson v. Virginia standard now. No more arguing that the verdict wasn't supported by the weight of the evidence. They have to convince the court that no reasonable jury could have reached that guilty verdict with the evidence that was presented.
So they have to really focus on showing that the evidence was just not there at all.
Exactly. And this is a great example for law students of how legal standards change over time.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in response to issues that come up, sometimes because of different views of how the system should work.
And it shows that understanding those standards, those procedures, is as important as knowing the law itself.
Absolutely. And for anyone working on these kinds of cases, it means they have to be extra careful at trial, making sure the record is clear, the evidence is solid, because that's what the appeals court is going to be looking at under this Jackson standard.
It's fascinating, right? These two cases, just because they share a name, they give us this really amazing view of the Texas legal landscape. The 1964 case is all about making sure the defense is doing their job and considering things like mental health. And the 2010 case changes the whole game for how appeals work. It's like two sides of the same coin.
I think you put that perfectly. They both show, in different ways, how Texas is constantly working on its justice system, trying to make it more fair and effective. The 64 case expands the rights of defendants, while the 2010 case refines the process for reviewing those trials.
They're both about trying to make sure the system is working as well as it can. So if you're a law student listening to this, what are the big takeaways from these Brooks v. Texas cases?
I say there are two really important lessons here. First, from the 1964 case, never underestimate the importance of thoroughly investigating every possible angle, especially when mental health is involved. Providing effective counsel isn't just about being in the courtroom. It's about the hard work you do before you even get there.
Preparation is key.
Absolutely. And then the 2010 case, that one teaches us how crucial it is to know the exact rules for appeals in your jurisdiction. And in Texas, that means mastering the Jackson v. Virginia standard and knowing that you can't just argue that the jury got the facts wrong. You have to show that there was no way a rational jury could have convicted based on the evidence.
And that means making sure everything's documented, everything's on the record at trial.
Exactly. Because that trial record, that's all the appeals court has to go on.
These cases, even though they're about different things, they both tell us that procedure matters, that the rules are just as important as the facts of the case.
Absolutely. Procedure, the way things are done, that can make or break a case. It's as important as any legal argument.
So true. It's like they say, the devil's in the details, and in the law, those details are often about procedure. These two cases, separated by so many years, really highlight how our system is constantly balancing things, trying to protect individual rights while also making sure that jury verdicts mean something. Where do you think these standards go from here? What's the next chapter?
That's a great question. And I think, honestly, that's something we'll all be watching as the law continues to evolve.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens, for sure. Well, thanks for taking this deep dive with me. It's been a really illuminating look at two landmark cases in Texas law.
My pleasure. Always happy to dig into the intricacies of the legal world.
And for all you law students out there, keep those books open and those minds sharp, because there's always something new to learn.
You bet. And remember, those procedural rules, they're not just boring technicalities. They can make all the difference.
Couldn't have said it better myself. All right. Until next time, keep those legal minds engaged.